This is the one here?
Yeah, that's just
okay.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen. Ladies and gentlemen, we'd like to start. Our program officer is among the missing, but we think that he's out in the men's restroom finishing his haiku. He only had 12 syllables done earlier this morning, so it may be that that's what's happening. This is our closing panel, and we think it's going to be a very good one. We are trying to keep a conversational atmosphere. We have declared this an almost PowerPoint-free zone. Some people couldn't help it. Laura's brought a slide. Paul brought a slide. You know, people have to have this withdrawal go through carefully so it doesn't affect their basic health. But here's the order of things for us. Paul, who is chair of the Sustainability Committee, and many of you have worked with him, is going to start off with some introductory remarks for us. And then Kevin Guthrie, whom I think many of you know, Laura Campbell, and Chris Greer, are going to have about 10 minutes each to really respond to the question, what was the problem you were trying to solve? You know, when you set up JSTOR, when you set up Ithaca, when you got going in the NDIP project, when all of Chris's interest in sustainability and the whole new cyber infrastructure issue, what was it you were trying to do? What was, to use the term of an economist whom we all heard at Martin's meeting at Emory, Paul Courant, who we hope will very much be involved with us on this, what was the demand that you were trying to satisfy? So we'll have some remarks from the panelists, conversation among them. We'd like to open it up to questions and observations that you have. Paul will come back at the very end for about 5 minutes, because one of the points of this is to create a task force on sustainability to look at these issues. So he'll come back with some ideas about how we might proceed on that. We obviously can't set up the whole thing today. And then finally, at the very end, our esteemed program officer, and we hope that he will have finished his haiku and will give us closing remarks around that. So, Mr. Berkman.
This is actually very exciting, after 3 years of working with the Sustainability Standing Committee and NSDL and many stakeholders, to have this discussion convened. In the spirit of a non-PowerPoint presentation and to try and be concise with my remarks, I've written them out. So bear with me as I read them to some extent. This session emerged from a proposal by the Sustainability Standing Committee to create a task force on digital library sustainability, an idea that had been introduced in January 2005 went to the Federal Managers Group of Science and Technology Information, CENDI. Digital libraries have common interests in sustainability that are relevant to their long-term evolution, individually and collectively. The problem is that digital libraries have been considering sustainability issues along parallel paths, largely in a fragmented manner, without synergy. The goal of this session is to consider the dimensions of a task force that will enable digital libraries to leverage their common interests in sustainability. The annual planning committee, chaired by Susan Van Gundy, is to be applauded for their efforts throughout this meeting and for facilitating this community discussion on a topic that is critical to the National Science Digital Library and digital libraries in general. Once in 100 generations, a transformational information technology is invented. Consider, for thousands of years, Neolithic humans shared their life stories on cave walls with smoke handprints and etched colors, or on rocks with stick figures and symbols, etched for future generations. Immovable, these images on stone have weathered the test of time. Then, nearly 5,500 years ago, clay tablets awakened a new capacity for humans to share experiences and insights. Rolling devices, the ancestor of all typesetting, enabled humans to imprint and reproduce symbols in clay. Clay also had the advantage of being much easier to transport than stone, but it was more fragile. 1,000 years later, humans invented papyrus, and we were often running with our ability to exchange information with much greater detail and color than ever before. Papyrus was lighter and more resilient than clay, which enhanced our ability to distribute information. Pieces of papyrus also could be combined to create complex information sources. After another 1,000 years, we saw the advent of paper, which certainly must rank as one of the most significant inventions in our civilization. For the next 2,000 years, until shortly after the Great Library of Alexandria, near the start of the Common Era, clay, papyrus, and paper coexisted as media for communicating information across time and space. On a global scale, paper then took off as the principal medium for sharing information with books and eventually printing presses. Until the second half of the 20th century, paper was unrivaled as the medium for sharing knowledge in our world. Then along came the digital medium, which, if the past is any indication of the future, is likely to be with us for millennia. With each transition, the new medium has increased the capacity to produce, distribute, and integrate information. Conversely, the capacity to preserve information seems to have decreased over the millennia. Once in 100 generations, we have the opportunity to consider strategies to manage information and truly transform education and knowledge discovery in our civilization. We live in a special period with great opportunity as well as serious responsibility for future generations. Looking backward, we recognize that information in our world has been managed largely through libraries and archives. These two information management architectures, while similar in their needs to preserve information and facilitate information access, have fundamental differences. Archives manage information based on the context of records linked to specific activities and transactions, like the Bureau of Motor Vehicles records of your car title. Libraries largely manage information based on the content of the information resources, as with the subject categories in the Dewey Decimal System. Beyond content and context, there is a third element of information that is necessary to provide meaning, and that is the structure of information. For example, when a message is encrypted, i.e. the structure is altered, it still has content and context, but no meaning absent the key to unlock the encryption. Similarly, if the names or dates and places are removed from an information resource, it still has content, context, and structure, but limited meaning without the salient facts. Removing context features that can be used to authenticate an information resource also will compromise its meaning. The paradigm shift created by digital technologies is the opportunity to utilize the structure of information as well as its content and context. A printed book can be managed based on its content as in libraries or its context as in archives, but it's not possible to break a book into smaller units that can be managed automatically. It is this ability to automatically manipulate the granularity of information resources that distinguishes digital media from all of the hard copy predecessors that have been applied throughout human civilization. Such insights about the underlying technological features of the digital medium are necessary, but not sufficient to create digital libraries that can be sustained into the digital future, into the distant future. There is no roadmap for sustaining digital libraries. There are, however, common interests among diverse digital libraries that we can build on, as I show you up here. These common interests include needs to establish functional frameworks for the public good, valued collections and services, resilient public and private partnerships, effective preservation of digital objects, and practical revenue-generating strategies. Public goods are non-rival resources that are shared but not depleted by communities of users. Such open access is a paradox because there is no incentive for users to pay for something that they can get for free. Consequently, public goods generally require institutional and government support to be sustained. Recognizing the financial limitations of government agencies, the National Science Digital Library and digital libraries more generally need to solve the paradox of public goods. Part of the financial solution involves collections and services that have value to communities of users. Value is an issue of demand, for without demand, there is neither means nor justification for support. Fortunately, libraries and now digital libraries serve an unending demand for education. It is, however, incumbent on the libraries to create collections and services that justify support. In every case, the digital library should consider: what drives the economic engine of the digital library? What is the digital library passionate about? What is the digital library best at in the world? Earlier this month, with support from the Mellon Foundation, Martin Halbert convened a conference at Emory University on digital library sustainability. Among the ideas that came out of this conference was the suggestion that digital libraries share characteristics with ecosystems. Perhaps, like ecosystems, interconnections among digital libraries across a centralized, distributed continuum will enhance their stability. The notion of ecosystem also points to the need to create an arena of interdisciplinary collaboration to solve the problems of digital library sustainability. As Chris Greer indicated a few weeks ago in one of the Sustainability Standing teleconferences, the issue is not whether there should be a task force, but what should the task force do? Objectives of this discussion with our distinguished panelists and you, the audience, are to go beyond an academic discussion and to consider practical issues associated with forming a task force on digital library sustainability. What is the charge of the task force? Who will be involved in the task force, and what will be expected of its members? How will the task force be organized and funded? With an overriding focus on education and knowledge discovery, libraries, whether hard copy or digital, are community jewels for learning. In our new digital era, libraries with valued collections and services have the potential to empower a worldwide culture of education. If we are successful here today, this session will provide guidance for justifying, supporting, and implementing a task force that will help to spin this education culture into action with innovative business and organizational strategies to sustain digital libraries individually and collectively into the distant future. Thank you very much, and I look forward to a very robust discussion. Thank you each.
Thank you very much. Everybody's got a little clicker on the bottom of their microphone, so there's on and there's off. I think
this
technology. You're on.
Okay,
so
I'm on.
Kevin, let's start with you.
I'm on in every way, I guess. Well, it's going to be a little challenging for me to give the background that I need to give in just 10 minutes, so I may talk fast, and please forgive me for that. Paul, that was a very a great introduction. I think the history and the context provides a nice backdrop, but I'll have to say that I'm in the very practical. I mean, I'm going to come at this from a very practical level, and at times, I think the question of ecosystem, the thoughts that I have come from the perspective of an organism within the ecosystem as opposed to the system overall, and I think I just wanted to give that as a background bias or context. How many of you are aware of what JSTOR is? Maybe a quick raise of hands. So pretty much everyone. I've been involved in two organizations over the last 12, 13 years. One is JSTOR and the other is Ithaca. And what we were asked to do was to talk about what was the demand, what motivated us to start these organizations, what motivated me to be involved in them. So you all know that JSTOR is a database of the back issues of journals, and that it's promotes a new kind of access to material which was very hard to get at in print. And that it's very useful for faculty and students. That's not actually what we were originally aiming to deliver with JSTOR. It was connected to what we were trying to do, but it wasn't the real motivator. The original motivator for JSTOR was that these journals were on shelves in libraries, and they were taking up lots and lots of space, and the technology was changing our world. And Bill Bowen, actually, who was the president of Mellon, who was on the trustees of Denison University. Denison was building a huge, off-site repository and adding to their library. And Bill said, gosh, do we really need to do this? I mean, what's in the library? Isn't a lot that's in the library in lots of libraries? And so he came back from that meeting. That was in about 1993, before the web was really out there. But he came back and said, is there some way that we can use digital information to save the system resources in addition to making this material more accessible? So it was really driven by the notion that we're talking about here, technology changing the way we use information. And fundamentally, Bill Bowen's an economist, it was about the economics. It was about that shelf space had a real cost on campuses, and that was going to be, he had a vision that was going to be changed over time, that we were going to be more reliant on the digital realm, and that these resources should be centralized, that we should engage in a collaboration. So JSTOR emerged really out of this notion of working collaboratively. And so it does have a system-wide perspective. But what originally I think Bill thought about setting this up at a university or in an existing organization. But it was very difficult to do that, and for a variety of reasons, some of them about competitive rivalries, some of them about entrepreneurship and innovation. And so he thought, well, we need to start up something new. So that I just happened to be working at Mellon at the time, so I happened to be a person who was in the right place at the right time, and I had an MBA, and so he encouraged me during a summer between two things to work on a business plan for that organization. So I've been involved with JSTOR from the very beginning, and you know, the demand that we were trying to address had two parts. One was this notion, it was fundamental that if we were going to realize the economic benefits, JSTOR had to be an archive. And it had fundamentally to address the question of long-term preservation of the materials that it would digitize. So number one, it had to be an archive. Number two, it had to be accessible, it had to be useful. Because therein, in the bundle of those two things, was the opportunity to generate resources, to generate self-sustainable economic model. So those two things were part of it. And I actually came from a perspective that was, I had started a small software firm, and then I had written a book at Mellon about the New York Historical Society. So I'd had a technological background and then a background in thinking about long-lived cultural assets. So we set up an economic model that was to try to create both an ongoing revenue stream for JSTOR and a capital base, a kind of an endowment, to deal with the archival issues. So my point here is only to say that we understood that the mission had to match the economic model that would be created that had an archival component and had an ongoing access component. And we tried to match everything about the organization to fit those goals and to create the capacity to generate the resources on an ongoing basis. And JSTOR now does have an endowment and has developed an economic model, and it's a self-sustaining economic model. And the community can trust that JSTOR will be around and can start to make decisions about transferring from the print to the electronic. So in working on JSTOR, and I worked at JSTOR for 10 years, I still am involved on the Board of Trustees, but there were other demands that were coming in as part of our work on JSTOR. And that was where Ithaca was born. Now, many of you probably don't know what Ithaca is. Fundamentally, what Ithaca is like a venture capital incubator for not-for-profits. What happened with JSTOR was the Mellon Foundation started this new organization. And our experience with that was that the new organization was able to do things that all the existing organizations couldn't have done for a variety of reasons. And of course, in the commercial sector, innovation happens in many cases with new enterprises. I mean, all the new things that we use regularly now, many of them, whether it's Google or eBay or whatever thing that we might be using, Amazon, Dell, they're all brand new. I mean, if we had to rely on IBM for all the innovation or these larger companies, we probably wouldn't see the same kind of innovation that we have. So there is in the venture capital industry, it's this move toward new innovative things. And so Ithaca was formed because we didn't feel that foundations and the culture around foundations and grant making was conducive to creating sustainable enterprises. That foundation and grant making has a tendency to look, to use a geometric kind of analogy, like a segment. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. Whereas the venture capital industry or sustainability looks at things in terms of a vector. There's a start and an ongoing representation. And you can't actually, in a venture capital firm, liquidate or get a return on your investment until the marketplace perceives this to be a vector. And therefore, you can realize the liquidity. So the notion of an organization that could work with foundations to create sustainability models, business plans, and that approach at an early stage of the grantees process, we thought would be a very valuable thing. There really isn't much like Ithaca out there, and you know, it's sort of hard sledding when you're new in some ways. But Ithaca is doing three kinds of services. We incubate new organizations, and there are three organizations that we're working on, and if there's time, I won't talk about them now, but each of those has a demand that it's responding to. And we also provide research on issues of sustainability for our community and strategic services both to these incubated entities and to other organizations. So that gives you a brief background on where I'm coming from. As we have the discussion, you'll understand, I think, some context. But fundamentally, in all these cases, it was always responding to the perception of a need and demand and then trying to match an economic model to those needs and trying to find the constituency that would be willing to pay and being able to make a compelling case to that constituency to have them pay on an ongoing basis.
Kevin, thank you very much. Laura and Dip.
Let's see. Oh, it works. First, let me ask you, as Kevin asked about JSTOR, and I don't think I'll see as many hands, how many of you are familiar with NDEP? Oh, okay, very interesting. I think we have a job to do here in terms of communication. My experience, as I'm listening to Kevin, is not dissimilar. In the early 90s, actually late 80s, Jim Billington, who's the Librarian of Congress, came to me and said, well, Laura, you got the business background. How about we put a business plan together? I have an idea. And the idea wasn't just an idea, it was a huge vision. And this was well before public access to the internet and really before widespread distribution of CD-ROM. In an institution that had a lot of content but no distribution channel. And I remember thinking in those early days, boy, he plans on breaking all the marketing rules. New product, new service, no distribution channel, new audience. I mean, when do I tell him this is not a good idea? And so he gave me 2 weeks, because he doesn't mess around, to get a business plan together. And I looked at the collections that had been digitized. We probably had about 10 collections digitized. And I thought, Lordy B, how am I going to tell him that the Emperor's got no clothes on here as a plan? So I nervously went in. I'd been a consultant to him for about 5 years since the time he'd come to the library, and I just blurted it out. I thought, well, I might as well tell him the truth. And he was very patient about hearing that news. He said, well, I think we should just get some basic clothes, some underclothes on the Emperor. And I thought, well, okay, if he can hear the truth, I guess we'll head down this road together. I did bother to ask him, who do you think the audience is for this endeavor? And essentially I worded it as, who did you think the market was going to be? And I got a 55-minute lecture where I was so outclassed, I just quietly folded up my little portfolio, smiled nicely, and left the room and thought, oh, my God, this is mission impossible. Well, we raised $13 million in 3 months, Dave Packard, John Kluge, and the Kellogg Foundation, and we were the dog that caught the car, and that's all history now. Thank God it's history. I remember one of my early colleagues, Ricky Irway, saying to me, if she'd gone to some international conference in the mid-90s, maybe you know Ricky, she works with RLG, and she came screeching into my office. She said, I got really bad news. And I said, what is it? And she nervously said, you know, I didn't know we were leading, but others are following. Isn't it scary? And so today we have American Memory and the National Digital Library Program. And in the late 90s, we understood that it wasn't enough just to be digitizing these unique materials and making them widely available, that what we really needed to do was to start to pay attention as the National Library and the world's largest library to collecting things that are born digital, that are at risk, that if we don't catch them now, they're not going to be here for Congress, for you today, for researchers, scholars, or future generations. So NDEP was born, just like Ithaca was born. Amazing similarities. We maybe are in different universes a little bit, but the story is very similar. Because no one library can do this all alone, we're going to build a universal library to preserve and sustain material over the long term. Congress, through the National Digital Information Infrastructure and Preservation Program, inelegantly called NDEP, we're developing a national network of partners, essentially, who are making major contributions to this network. The program was mandated by Congress in December of 2000, at which point I got a call from my chief of staff, and she said, where are you? I said, I'm on Route 28, getting ready to get on the toll road, coming down. She said, pull over. And I did, and she said, Merry Christmas. This was December 5th. And I said, what are you talking about? And she said, Ted Stevens managed to get us $100 million last night at the White House. I said, oh, my God. We were now the dog that had definitely caught the bus. I thought American Memory was hard. I mean, I haven't had too many good full sleep nights since then. At any rate, Congress had the same question. that Bill Bowen at Mellon had, is who's going to pay for all this? Yes, they recognize the need, like major periods in history. There's great loss if you don't understand and evolve and transform with the changing technology. They got the problem, but they also understood that $100 million was going to be a drop of ink in the ocean for how big the scale of this problem could be. So their question has been, who is going to pay? It is our job to model and test these partners who are collecting and preserving in the NDEP network ways in which we can get committed as a group to defined roles and responsibilities for sharing this responsibility long term. So we have about a decade to do this evidence experience together and to tell our story. By the year 2010, we need to go back to Congress and to make recommendations about who is going to pay, who's going to do the selecting and collecting, who's going to do the preserving, where are the new business models, what are the economics of this network, and how are we going to be able to take full advantage of the resources that we've put in place. In other words, we've got a huge opportunity to tell a fabulous story. The stewardship network, as far as I'm concerned, is going to evolve over time. We are at the very baby steps, the beginning of this evolution. None of us know between the political, technical, social, financial forces that are going on where all of this is likely to end up. But I have some ideas, and I want to share them with you in the next few minutes. The problem that we really think that we're solving here with the NDEP program is, as stewards of the intellectual heritage of this country, the library wants to make certain that we have done as good a job as we can with the resources we have to capture and sustain knowledge and information. That is our mission at the library, and that's what we plan on doing, is catching things that are important to have. Some things are interesting and not very important. We are really considering that which has high educational value. The educational well-being of this country is going to depend upon an informed society. Someday, some administration will take on the cause of a public utility for information, just like you have electricity today. We all expect to have light, sewer, and water. Well, in the future, you're going to have that expectation. Your children, your grandchildren are going to want to have easy to access, reliable, authentic information as a utility. The benefits, I think, are simple, high quality, reliable, and authentic content. A continually expanding body of knowledge and information. The benefits to a network are that we get to share some of the costs, we learn from one another, we create our own social network, we learn by doing. I know in the National Science Digital Library Program, you're doing the very same thing we're trying to do. I've heard Kay give a very wonderful talk in New Orleans at ALA about your effort, and when I listened to that, I thought, oh my goodness, we're trying to do the same thing. You're just doing it in the sciences, we're doing it in the humanities. Wouldn't it be nice if we get together? And fortunately, Dan Atkins comes to the National Science Foundation with cyber infrastructure, and his colleague, Chris Greer, whom you're going to hear from, is all of a sudden a perfect partner for the humanities. If you can possibly imagine where I'm headed with this, is if we're going to tell a story to Congress, we need to leverage that story. We need to take the good work that's taking place and tell the most compelling story we can. In our first phase of investments in NDEP, we have 67 partners that are collecting content, developing technical architecture, and with NSF, we've funded 10 research grants for basic digital preservation research. The collecting and preserving partners, there are 8 consortia, 36 partners collecting and testing preservation on geospatial materials, social science data sets, Southern culture, websites, public television, and business records. The birth of the dot-com era. Think about it. If somebody doesn't collect that story now, that huge technology boom, that period of economic history is going to be lost forever. University of Maryland and a consortium are working on that very problem. We are fortunate enough to have in the development of new business models and services, several partners, Ithaca and Portico being one of them, working with journal publishers and that community, and many interesting NSF research grants. So these are the 67 institutions or agreements that we have in the first phase. In the second phase of NDEP, which is beginning this year, we're going to make investments that will bring our partnerships to over 100. We're going to expand the existing network. We will be adding state governments. We don't have enough money to add every state government, so we're going to do demonstration projects in multi-state repositories for at-risk content. We are going to include commercial entities in the film, music, and video gaming and cartooning communities to our network of partners. They're particularly confused about what to do about metadata and standards. They're motivated to keep care of their content, but no one's bringing them together to talk about these other things. They're in competition. And then we're going to do another round of NSF funding. And fourth, we are going to put more money into our existing partners to strengthen and expand their networks. This has become a networks within networks, where we have, for instance, in our geospatial community, a growing and expanding set of partners in just that area. Martin here today is one of our partners. I'm certain he can tell you his view of this work. So how are we really building this network? We started out seeding it, and we have taken a strategy of learning by doing. It's an iterative process where, in fact, we take the evidence and the learning from the first round of investments and plow it into the second investments. And now we're developing our concept of a whole stewardship network. I need good advice from both these people sitting on either side of me to make certain that we make the right investments, because we think we see the future of a stewardship network in a similar way. There's a lot more I could say about NDEP and its future, but I think the problem we're trying to solve is education, its competitiveness in this country and in the world. It is better cultural understanding. It is leveraging our resources, our very scarce resources, and telling Congress why they ought to want to care. Someday in the future, we'll have a universal library, and a lot of the agreements will be worked out. Maybe even some of the copyright issues will get worked out. But I think the only way we're going to do it is to continue to pay attention to the evolutionary steps and start to take these key species, as Paul would say, in his ecosystem. And I look at the three of us and the projects we have as maybe key components in that ecosystem, and make certain that we are wise about leveraging what we can do together. So I'm really excited about the task force. I need their help, and I'm happy that you all are interested in this. This is terrific. I turn this back to you, Kay.
Laura, thanks very much. Chris, so partnerships, leveraging, and you are the target for everyone.
That was just to make me feel comfortable. Well, I think you'll see from the discussion.
It's on, by the way. Can people hear?
How's that? Everything okay? All right. I think you'll see from the discussion that there's considerable commonality of interest and overlap of approaches, and most important, there's a real determination to proceed, to move forward. And I think that's probably the most important message that we can send out today, and that is that we are determined to make progress, to take on some of these hard issues, and to work with folks like you in partnerships to make that happen. Like my compatriots up here, we've experienced this flood of digital information. Many of the research that we fund results in a flood of digital products that are not only the products of research, but the starting point for research by others and items for education and educational tools development for others. Projects on the board like the National Ecological Observatory Network, NEON, a continental scale observatory of streaming data from sensors to understand how our continent operates in a better way. The Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, or LSST, intended to capture a picture of the entire visible night sky once a week with a 3 billion pixel camera generating 30 terabytes of data every night. So quite a data challenge in and of itself. So Michael Lesk at Rutgers has estimated that in the year 2007, around the planet, society will generate more than 10 exabytes of data. That's 10 to the 18th. For reference, Tom Landauer estimates that the average human mind, not mine, I dragged down the average, the average human mind holds 200 megabytes of data. And so what this means is that most of the information produced with NSF support will never be read by any human. Instead, it will be cataloged, analyzed, documented, and made available by machines. And so this is a significant challenge that we face. As Paul has pointed out, we have this progression from stone to clay to papyrus to paper, and now to digital, with great advantages in each of those steps, including, as he said, transportability and density. Other things like the ability to recapitulate the physical world in four dimensions. Imagine a library where they want to use your collection in four-dimensional space. That library looks quite a bit different from current sorts of libraries. Also allows you to manipulate the content on the fly and to remove these barriers of time and space. You don't have to travel to the Library of Congress. You can use the American Memory Collection, whether in North Dakota or Thailand or wherever. So those are crucial, but along with those advantages go some disadvantages, and one of them is the fragility of digital collections. Along the same progression Paul talked about, you see increasing fragility at every step, and so I think that's a major challenge that we face in the digital library universe, and one that NSF is well aware of. And so the problem we're trying to solve, there was a report about 10 years ago from the Task Force on Archiving of Digital Information, which was convened by the Coalition on Preservation and Access and the Research Library Groups and Libraries Group, and probably all of you have seen it. It would be a good time to get it out again. It's on the RLG website, but the challenge that they issued at the time is still relevant today, and I'll read that challenge. If we are effectively to preserve for future generations the corpus of information in digital form that represents our cultural record, we need to commit ourselves technically, legally, economically, and organizationally to the full dimensions of the task. Now, when that task force said to commit ourselves, they weren't referring to the members of the task force. They were referring to society as a whole. And so this challenge won't be solved by NSF acting alone, by the Library of Congress acting alone, by each of you in your endeavors acting alone, but rather through broad partnerships in which society as a whole commits itself to the preservation of the digital products of our culture, including our science. So the goals of the National Science Foundation are driven by a vision that has three pieces. This is a vision for a digital data universe in which data are routinely collected in well-documented form. Wouldn't that be a wonderful new step? That those data can be found, readily found, and easily understood by people who are specialists and people who are not specialists. And there are some crucial research challenges underlying that part of the vision. And that finally, those data are openly accessible while properly protected and reliably preserved. Now, that last part of the vision requires a network of sustainable repositories of the type that Laura was referring to, not a single repository, rather a network that has the robustness of systems like the print library system that exists now, where There are libraries in the international realm, the national or federal realm. The Library of Congress is an example. In the state and local governments, in academic environments, in for-profit institutions, and in not-for-profit foundations. These libraries have a wide range of business models, with each library having a diversity of funding sources, not relying on funds from any single source. Again, NSF is not going to be the sole answer to this problem. It's through a diversity of business models that we can create the robustness in a federation that provides for the preservation of information. And so the libraries that we're talking about, the libraries of the future, will require a range of expertise, and a range of partnerships are necessary to put together that expertise. So not just the ability to organize information, but the computer and information science skills that keep that library on the forefront of technology, which is where it's going to have to stay. The march of technology is a highly disruptive force in the information preservation world, and it's something we all have to build in to our plans and our business models. That's simply there. And so computer and information science technology is critical. Cyber infrastructure capability, the ability to deliver that product to your users. Archival sciences, how to preserve for the long run. And all of these things have to be brought together in individual organizations and institutions. And so those are all partnerships. We also have to create a series of partnerships for support, partnerships that engage the federal government, the state and local governments, the private sector, and the academic sector. And so I look forward to this discussion. I think it is time to make progress, to have a deep, thoughtful study of where we've come in the 10 years since the CPA-RLG report. Many important experiments like NSDL, the NDIP program, providing rich information to study, to analyze thoughtfully, and to make projections for the future. And so I'm looking forward to the discussion of those issues. Thank you.
Chris, thanks very much. Let's open it up. Who would like to be the brave first person? Maybe some questions among the panelists yourselves for each other, given what you've heard from each other.
One of the things I'd love to hear from Laura is how she views the NDIP and NSDL partnerships working. How can we proceed with that?
I think that after hearing, and I have to say I did not have great familiarity with the NSDL effort. I read about it, but when I heard Kay talk in New Orleans, it was very clear to me that we were experiencing so many of the same challenges. You know, in many ways, technology isn't the biggest challenge we've got. It's who's going to do what for whom. It's the human. It's the cultural change. This is a transformation that's going to go on for a long time. And I think one of the things, I can't speak for Kay, and Kay ought to hop in here, but one of the things that I think we do share is that, you know, the problem that we're solving is not sustaining digital libraries. That's the how. The what, the vision is trying to improve the quality of education and the availability of knowledge and information, whether it's in the sciences or it's in the humanities, for the long term. A rich body of important content. And I think we share that, and so I think working together is going to be fun, and it's going to be easy, because at least I think the players in both these arenas are committed to making that difference. They're already the out front doing the transformation. I think it's how we tell the story and how we choose to do the things that help tell the story the best.
Go ahead,
can I jump
Kevin.
In? I'm going to try to bring it down a little bit to, I don't.
It's the MBA.
I'm no, I think it's the the one with the scars of trying to start up something new, in a very from scratch. So I have a couple of questions or thoughts maybe that I can put into for people to think about. So one of the big issues, obviously, that everyone talks about is open access, and connected to open access, I mean, I think we all agree that open access is what we all should shoot for completely. And one of the drivers for why we think we can think about open access now is the notion that the marginal cost of delivering these resources to the nth user is zero, or approaches zero. And I would like to first throw out the distinction that it's different to approach zero than to be zero. So there are real costs, and there are real costs on the margin. They're very small, but and if the scale of your project is small, those costs will not be large. And in fact, they may be able to be hidden within other costs, and then you can deal with them. So my point here is just to say that a small number multiplied times a small number is a small number. But a small number multiplied times a very, very big number is a big number. And I mean, what I mean to say by that is that if you are successful in delivering access, you are going to have significant costs. And so, you know, what I think that raises are two. So I'll give you an example with JSTOR. JSTOR recently made its index available to Google. Prior to that, it was not available to Google. So Google can search JSTOR. You can do a Google search now, and if you're at a participating, anyone in the world can make a Google search and find content with a full text search that's in JSTOR. If you're a participating institution, it'll be invisible to you, you'll get access. Since we've done that, the amount of referrals from the world to JSTOR is going up by orders of magnitude in 3 months. So that the scale of that is such that we have to buy things. We have to buy servers. We have to respond to that, even if we don't provide the actual access. So there's that issue. Connected to that, if you take the Library of Congress example where you mentioned that the Library of Congress now has the opportunity to serve the world. That is a wonderful thing. That is a costly thing. So the Library of Congress previously had regulators on usage of that resource that were time and place, hours of being open. You know, I went to the Library of Congress when I was in high school and needed to get a book, and it took a long time to put the thing in the little thing and wait for the ramp to bring the book back and all that. That's all changed. And it's a huge opportunity to take advantage of that, but I think the reality is that the libraries that exist in the old model were built around a local constituency, and a local constituency that chose to pay. So whether it's a public library or university library, even the Library of Congress, whose local constituency is the United States of America, now they have the opportunity to serve way beyond their constituency, which fundamentally is a good thing, but practically, for that entity, costs money. So if you have lots of excess capacity, that's not a problem. But if you use a resource like the New York Public Library and you are a New York City resident and you start to get slow access because everybody else is getting it from all over the world, you may ask those trustees, should you be providing that access to everyone else? I'm paying. So there's some practical issues around constituencies and paying. My third and last comment on this is that when you move away from an environment where the beneficiary or the recipient of the service is paying for it, you have an agency problem. That is to say, I may try to appeal to the NSF or to the Mellon Foundation or the library, or whatever, to government, to pay for something that I'm delivering to someone else. There's a triangle. That's a good thing, but particularly in a mission-based context and a public good context, it's very difficult for us when we're dealing with that recipient to develop the metrics to show that third party how it is we're delivering on our mission. So we end up having, you know, the reality is that if you're dealing with a funder, the funder's your customer. I mean, you have to make the funder happy. You have to figure out how to make the funder happy, and it's a more challenging job to do that by telling them that you're doing a great work over here, because it's difficult to measure the return on a not-for-profit mission. So that triangle is problematic. So while open access is a wonderful thing, I think it's important to recognize that it removes a motivator and incentive at the level of the provider that is very useful to frame and exert discipline on the process. So, you know, JSTOR is bad, quote unquote, from an open access point of view, because it's not freely available. But I can tell you that JSTOR is incredibly motivated to make sure that the content that's in JSTOR is what the libraries and faculty at these institutions want to have in it. We can't do otherwise, or they won't they won't actually pay. So our goal was actually to make the cost very, very, very low, to make access as widely available as possible and sustain the resource. But it's not all the way there. It's not open access. So those are just some broad principles, three principles that I would just throw out to the audience. You know, tell me I'm crazy, tell me it doesn't make sense, but those are some thoughts that I would add.
Yeah, another thing that Kevin and I talked about briefly this morning is so many of our projects, quite typically of a lot of NSF projects, are embedded in universities. And it's very easy, especially as a faculty member, I think once you become a dean, this is much less easy, but it's very easy to forget the value of the free services, free in a certain context, being provided to you as you run. Kevin was giving the example of a faculty member running a journal with 200 subscribers. You can do that out of your office, and you can be completely blind to the costs that are being taken care of, in essence, by the general university budget. So this whole enterprise means a culture shift for a lot of us, and I think the issue of the scale of the enterprise, I mean, we've already run into that in aspects of NSDL, as I'm sure everyone has. It comes with quite a shock that success has a price to you. Anyone from the audience want to jump in here? Yes, sir. Well, and the limitation, as we all know, and Laura may want to, anyone can jump into this, the limitation of volunteer work, I mean, that's been something I think NSDL and many other things like us have faced constantly. Not only is there free support within the universities and colleges and so on, free again in a certain sense, but the value of that labor that's contributed to NSDL and other such activities is a huge value, and we have to, you know, as Kevin is indicating, we have to assign a cost to that. Our National Visiting Committee, for example, has asked us, what does it cost? What does NSDL really cost? And when we are calculating that cost, part of that's going to have to be the volunteer labor of very active communities that have a real interest out of their vision and their passion, really, to contribute to it. So that has to go into the calculation. And there's a point of loss there, I think, at a certain point. Yeah, Laura.
We have a very large acquisitions budget at the library, and it has been expanded to acquire things that we don't get in through copyright or through donation to actually purchase digital resources and content. What we've learned in NDEP is that there is, over and over again, an incredibly strong relationship between the user and the content. Has a lot to do with the economics. It gets to the volunteer aspect of this, where you have peers in a community that have mutual interests in that data. They're going to contribute their effort and time to keep that data going. Where you don't have that stronger relationship between the content and the user community, there are big opportunities for economies of scale and the services that you see that Ithaca is trying to provide. So there will be, I think, a whole set of new business models and services that will be maybe hybrids of the organizations we have today. We will be paying for certain things because we can't afford not to, and because they provide a very valuable service to the whole community and other things. People are going to take care of themselves because I'm interested in that subject. That's my life's passion. And so I'm going to contribute. And then, of course, there'll be the public-funded support, and there'll be other ways in which this whole ecosystem turns out to share in the costs and the benefits.
I would come at your question slightly differently. The sustainability question, which I think is one of the overarching questions in this, has obviously the revenue side and it has the cost side. And it's the net that actually ends up mattering. In the case of the volunteer labor, this is the enormous opportunity of our time. The network enables this kind of volunteer. I mean, we see it everywhere. Many of the huge scale enterprises are fundamentally, whether it's when I say huge scale, I mean actively engaged, whether it's YouTube or eBay, or these things that are giant. Wikipedia, you can have your arguments about why, whether these things are high quality or useful, but there's no question that with very little centralized effort, they created massive amounts of activity and data. So the question I would ask of in your situation is not so much quite what does it cost for the volunteer labor, but is the volunteer labor sustainable? Can you make a case for why those people are going to continue to do it, as Laura said? Because if you can, in effect, what you're doing is you're saying, I can deliver this service for a much lower cost because I can depend upon this for this, this, and this. And so you drive down the cost side of your argument, and if you can make the case that that's a sustainable thing, that affects what you have to generate in terms of other revenue. If to use the example with Laura's example, the actual converting of material or maintaining the material, I don't think it's fundamentally different. I mean, at the end of the day, it's really what you've got to sustain once they digitize all their information, et cetera, that is the issue, I mean, to me. And I think thinking through how to sustain, whether it is lower costs or revenue generation in different ways, is the fundamental challenge.
Chris, did you want to add?
What I've been hearing in the last set of comments and the question is that we're only now, as a group of entities, coming to the realization that a comprehensive economic model or business plan has to take into account some very complex activities at many levels, starting with acquisition or ingest, with curation, with migration, with dissemination or delivery. And each one of those categories has major challenges which differ for the different instantiations of collections and libraries. But we do have some examples out there. We do have all of you folks thinking about this problem in each of those areas. And so I think it is time for a deep study of how each of these elements actually work. What are the variables? What information is out there? What first principles can be derived from the experiences that we've had in each of those areas, with the goal of developing a comprehensive understanding of the costs for real long-term preservation of the type that you all are trying to achieve.
Thanks. I'd ask, Martin, one last question.
Something that I think is really important in a period of change that I've heard each of you address in different ways is, what should be the guiding principles for institutionalizing new efforts? Kevin, you talked about
I've thought a lot about that, and it would take me a long. I mean, I'll send you some material. I'm available to you. I mean, I sort of have 9 steps. We're trying to start out new entities, and fundamentally those steps are around defining the charitable mission. I think separating the entity from the existing entity, even JSTOR, which is brand new and innovative organization, it's got a legacy to protect, and if it's trying to do something new that challenges that legacy, it's difficult. So in some sense, Ithaca has been created in order to do new things that could threaten JSTOR, but if they are successful, actually may come back and be part of JSTOR. So I think separating the enterprise, I think making the enterprise be enough out on its own that it knows what its costs are, and giving that leader the flexibility to generate capital and adjust the model of that enterprise. So there are a whole series of sustainability. There's no formula, obviously. There's no answer, but I think that there are steps that you can. That we pulled some of that from what happens in the for-profit sector, but there are some unique aspects that are for our sector, which are, and I think one of the biggest challenges is really forcing an enterprise to try to develop the metrics for measuring whether it is delivering on its not-for-profit mission. It's easier to end up just talking about the dollars and cents or ignoring it completely. Trying to figure out ways to quantify or at least objectify that which is a qualitative objective is a really, really important piece, I think, of that, because it helps you to make the case to your funders or just helps you to understand whether you're delivering. So I think that that there are real steps that I think are helpful that I'd be happy to share what we've learned over time, and the best way I've done a presentation on this. And you know, they're not the right nine things, but they're something to think about.
That we will take that, Kevin. That sounds
very good.
Volunteer. He's not charging for this. Okay.
One. He cares so much.
Yes, that's right. So last words from Laura and Chris?
Well, I would say that I go back to the strategic plan we put before Congress, and the kind of principles that we put out there are really we've tried to follow in terms of our overall strategy is to recognize that this is, in fact, there is no roadmap. This is modeling and testing, to learn by doing, to take early action so you could learn by doing, to be iterative so that you plow that knowledge in a very wise way because of your scarce resources into a second evolution or set of investments, to continue that iterative process, to be catalytic. And I think that our network within networks, Martin, you're familiar with those, is catalytic. They have taken on a force themselves because they have great mutual interest in the content and having the content accessible. And those have been our basic principles of moving forward, but there isn't any roadmap. And just like you've developed your, you know, nine steps, we are continuing to learn about what we should be paying attention to so that we are collectively, as the network, the 67 agreements now and will be bigger, over 100 by the end of the year, that we have really made the best decisions, and that includes refining those initial principles of how to build or transform a sustainable body of knowledge.
I want to reemphasize Paul's analogy to an ecosystem in terms of what we're trying to accomplish here. And so I think it's important for each of the entities that will be participating in that ecosystem to keep in mind keep a clear vision of who they are, what are their special capabilities, what is their mission, what are their limitations, and how does that affect how they fit within the ecosystem itself, whether you're a keystone species or one of the many components of the ecosystem. Who are you? What are you capable of doing? What's your mission in particular in the context of this larger network of institutions? And also, what are your connections within that network? How do you interact with prey and predator in this ecosystem? And finally, ecosystems are dynamic. That's an important feature of how they operate. And so how you respond to the changing landscape of that ecosystem and modify your approach, remain nimble and at the forefront of technology. This is a dynamic landscape, so built into your plans, into your mission, is going to have to be how to adapt to a rapidly changing landscape within a network of organizations like you. So I think it's a strong analogy and one that will help you in figuring out how to build your plans. Certainly influences how we think about how to proceed at the National Science Foundation.
Kevin has thought of one tenth step.
One last thing. In Ithaca, we've tried to get several organizations to work together, and one of them was to have a shared software development effort and get everybody to share a baseline infrastructure. It failed miserably. And it failed miserably on local interest and each of these entities having goals and needs that were on a certain timeline. What I would encourage, and I know nothing about how NSDL is working, I'm just guessing. What I would encourage is that you understand in each of your projects where your value really is. And wherever you can find a baseline infrastructure to share, try to share it. It will be against your instincts to do that. You will want to do it all yourself in a vertical stovepipe because you want to control it. You want to know that you have control over it. It's you that are delivering this thing. But I can tell you that that is good in the very, but it's challenging in the medium and longer term. And wherever you, what is happening in our community and the world is that things are new and then they become a commodity. They're new and then they become a commodity. Keep looking for those commodity layers and have NSDL or whatever, the try to get that infrastructure handled centrally or, you know, across, and do the things that you're really, really adding value to. Because I've seen that it's been very difficult to get different entities, and we see it in higher ed and we see it everywhere. How do we do this? Collaboration is required at the infrastructure level, but it's tough to get to.
I think while we're asking Paul to come up and talk to us about how we move forward with the idea of the task force, I'll say that we have an advantage, I truly believe, in this pathway structure that NSF has given us, because each of those pathways has stewardship for its community and is doing that very well. I think we are just at the point in our meeting on Wednesday where there's a real recognition of these are the elements that we all share. We'd like the model to be the model that we're currently using so we don't have to change anything, but I think a real recognition of just exactly the kind of thing that you're talking about, Kevin. So I hope that gives us some leverage on problems that everybody just holds their head about, so we might as well all hold our heads together, you know, there's some value in that. So, Paul.
Before saying anything, I'd like to thank Chris Greer, Laura Campbell, and Kevin Guthrie for their thoughtful comments. The issues of sustainability clearly extend across a continuum. As a PI on a project, I have interests that are related to that project. As a chair of a committee dealing with sustainability, I have concerns about sustainability in a macro sense. Each of us has different perspectives on sustainability. And in order to proceed, as Laura has mentioned several times, I think each of the panelists in one way or another mentioned, there is no roadmap. In order for us to successfully transition to take advantage of digital world that we're emerging into, we need to share our insights. We need to build this together. Both Laura and Chris have expressed an interest in moving forward in a very timely manner with the development of a task force. I will closely work with them, with Kay and other members of NSDL, as well as Chris and Laura, to do this as expeditiously as possible. But it's not something that I expect we can do in isolation. It requires community input. It requires your advice. It requires your thoughtful consideration. I would note a couple comments in terms of this discussion. The notion of digital libraries as libraries largely are in the public good. We're doing this in part for education, and the opportunities with using digital information to educate the world in new and exciting ways, which are different than what we've been experiencing through our lifetime, is an opportunity. One of the things that this task force could focus on is what are the case studies that are available to us. I mean, certainly NDIP has case studies in their progress from phase one to phase two. NSDL has case studies in its progress from going from collections and services to largely pathways-oriented support. There are learning experiences. What are those case studies that we can use? Laura mentioned that the Library of Congress has a humanities focus. And there's a rich opportunity in bringing together a science focus with a humanities focus. Understanding what the first principles are, whether it's humanities or science, would be helpful. There's been a great deal of focus on economics of sustainability. And clearly, at some very basic level, it hits each of us at our pocketbook. But on a macro scale, the economics is relevant. Perhaps in terms of sustaining digital libraries in general, there may be as important, if not more important, a component of the organizational strategies that we create, because clearly some entities like Library of Congress are going to have persistent levels of funding. But in the continuum from centralized to distributed digital libraries, there are small collections that arise out of an individual's passion in a laboratory that are not sustainable. And somewhere in that continuum, that individual collection is valuable. So as meaningful as the economic models are, creating organizational strategies which facilitate this digital library continuum are important. I would hope in the task force that we are able to tackle these issues, to consider the issues of ingestion, preservation, access, and use, and to truly come up with some very vibrant, forward-looking strategies dealing with this complex business model. So as next steps, I will work closely with the group here. I would welcome input. This is, again, not an isolated activity. It's intended to be inclusive. You have each thought about digital libraries passionately in one way or another. There is no roadmap. We're at once in 100 generations time period, and it requires a community of collective thought and wisdom to proceed. So again, I'd like to thank the panel. I'd like to thank Kay. I'd like to thank Susan Van Gundy and the Annual Planning Committee for facilitating this discussion. And I'd like to thank you, the audience, for your contributions.
Paul, thank you very much. Thanks to the Planning Committee and all of you who reviewed papers for this meeting. And we really need to thank the staff and leadership of AAAS for giving us an opportunity to meet in this very nice facility. Next year, we were thinking of meeting in Rome. How does that sound to everyone? All those in favor of meeting? Okay. Where is Dr. Zia? Now, those of you who are on this panel don't know that years ago in 1925, Lee started to close the meeting with a haiku. He has set very high levels of expectation for us, and he is here to present his closing haiku. I hope this is a really good one, Lee. No pressure.
So I need to put this thing. Did you mean Rome, not Rome, Georgia?
No, I did mean Rome, Georgia. Did you think? Yeah, Lee thinks, Dean thinks it's Rome, New York, yeah.
Or Rome, New York.
He's bending down here. You know, don't you feel like you're in a Saturday Night Live skit every time we do this? People disappearing behind the podium, people going under the table, people explaining how this almost works. Here comes technical assistance from all sides. That's right.
It's all about the angle.
That's right. Laura wants to know how many people, how many NSDLers does it take to put a stick in?
Cool. No, that's not it. Hold on a second. Let's try that one. 2006. This is 2006, right? Let's see. F5. This haiku thing is. Oh dear. But before we get to that, let me also add my thanks first to Paul and his sustainability committee working with the annual planning committee to put together what I think was a very, very stimulating panel. And I want to thank the panelists again, Kevin, Laura, Chris, and Kay for moderating. There's clearly a lot of opportunities for synergy amongst a lot of different sectors. I think that sort of reflects what we're seeing in NSDL. One of the interesting things for me in that program is how interdisciplinary it is. Almost all the projects have PI teams that bring, at least from university communities, but also for the projects that are not in not coming out of university communities, a collection of people and expertise that in the past has never really talked to each other. At a meta level, we're seeing the same sort of thing happening in the emergence of the potentials for this task force. So I really applaud this. I think we're on to something that's going to be very, very valuable. Just a couple of quick remarks. At our meeting last year, I closed by noting that the historian Arthur Schlesinger, I guess it's actually, in this particular case, it's Arthur Schlesinger Jr., has advanced a theory of history, in particular of American history, that's cyclical in nature. that there's a periodicity to the political and social and economic ecosystem, to use the word of the day instead of environment. What, of course, is always on the minds of people is what's the time constant, right? And you know, and you don't know whether you're in a trough or at a peak, and you're using those terms depends on your lots of other circumstances, your points of view, and so forth, and whether you're going up or going down, right? And as a mathematician, I can't resist talking about the sine of the first derivative. And I really appreciate a small number times a big number. Can be a very big number. And of course, you know, the social environment has changed a lot even from last year, right? MySpace and YouTube phenomena, as an example. Second Life was very, very small, really. They just had their millionth resident join. And we talked a little bit about that on yesterday, I guess. It was just yesterday morning. So things are very, very fluid, very, very dynamic. You know, we're in Washington, and so close to an election, I'm not going to offer an opinion. As a Fed, I have no opinion. But as a Fed, I do believe in government, whether it's the federal government, the state government, or local government. And I believe in government being able to enable things that are hard to do individually. That, I think, is a good and noble purpose of government. I'd like to see that we carry that out, and NSDL is a perfect opportunity, NDIP is a perfect opportunity, the kinds of things that are involved with cyber infrastructure provide us a perfect opportunity, because we're laying the groundwork and positioning NSDL and the larger digital universe and capabilities to serve the public good. So we're hearing a lot of examples about that. So specific to this meeting, what I heard cheers me no end. I'm hearing words like convergence, focus, partnership, engagement, and all of those words are backed up with passion, genuine substance, and commitment. Earlier, I said something about in a session, if perfect is the enemy of the good, and I think that that's not a new phrase to me. Many of you have heard that. So, but I have a version of that. I'd amplify that a little bit. I'd say that if perfect is the enemy of the good, then purpose is the ally of the great. And we have purpose, and we need to execute on that. So I'm looking forward to those next steps. Okay, so thanks. And a lot of blurbs. Haiku. Okay, so sure. Yeah, you know, it's a number of you. The first thing you said was not even hi. Where's the haiku? Okay, all right. So it's kind of fun, actually. It disciplines you a little bit. Okay, so here we go. Web 2.0, you can count your, I'm of the 575 variety, by the way. Web 2.0, Vaini Vidi Wiki blog, two-way trumps one-way. With apologies to our classicist and humanist. Sacrifice control, but gain mind share through usage. Determine value. And I have to say, I cooked up before I heard this panel, but I was amazed at the points of intersection. I think you'll see a few more. I was very, very pleased. The collective mind. Yeah, sorry. Okay, I'll go quickly. Embrace the spectrum. From sandbox to reviewed gem, tap the social mind. I think, Kevin, your comments about the volunteerism is very, very, very much part of that. Reuse, repackage, repurpose. It's a mindset, but recognize too. Uh, For custom service, privacy as currency, a new world beckons. Last one. Teachable moments, formal blurs to informal, and then back again. So thanks a lot. Safe travels.
Thank you, everybody.
Oh, my goodness.